Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. Today is February 6, 2018, and it is 1:31 in the afternoon. I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Meyer. Good afternoon.
Hey, thank you.
Senator Machicki. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And Senator Stevens. I'm Senator Mia Costello. Today we have two items on the agenda. Both are bills introduced by Senator Wilson, and please come forward. You're welcome to come forward with your staff. The first bill we're hearing is Senate Bill 62, repeal of Certificate of Need. This bill was heard on April 6th and April 7th of last year, and so we'll have the bill sponsor go through a summary to remind the members of what we heard last year, and then we have members online and here in the audience for invited testimony. We will then open it up for public testimony. So with that, welcome, Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As the Chair has mentioned, we've heard this bill twice before last year in committee, so I would give a very brief overview because I don't want to repeat our presentation in detail. You know, well-intended government laws and regulations can have unintended negative consequences, especially upon small business, to prevent expansion of the economy here in Alaska. Some of our government laws are well-intended, but they have led to limited customer choice of services, stifled competition, innovation, expansion in certain industries, including the transportation sector, as we heard lots of testimony upon the transportation network companies and taxis. We've heard this in the hospitality sector, currently going with the distilleries and bars and restaurants, and as well as the healthcare industry. These battles are ultimately created by our own government laws and regulations. While well-intended, they haven't quite worked out to Alaskans at times. Alaskans need and deserve a free market of law where laws supply and demand direct production of goods and services. The force of competition can help keep price low. Demand increases, price rise, competitions add to supply to create, compete for consumers' dollars. Prices lower both healthcare competitors on the supply market. Before we begin, we just want to make sure that everyone knows how complicated healthcare is. It's very complicated, and healthcare system is probably more complicated than we create in our government laws and our own human body. So we want to thank those who are willing to provide testimony here to do so and willing to do public testimony. We've heard this topic is have feelings of some that are not willing to come forth due to the pressure of some of the larger players and fearful of the loss of hospital privileges. This is not just in our state, but I've recently traveled and heard this from one of my colleagues in Georgia. Senate Bill 62 repeals the Alaska Certificate of Need, otherwise known as the CON program, and provides for a two-year window before the repeal becomes effective. We've examined the historic and current arguments for the Certificate of Need laws, and they do not provide economic justification for depriving consumers of the benefits of free markets. The Alaska Certificate of Need program poses a substantial threat for the proper performance of healthcare markets and services, creates barriers to entry and expansion to limit customers' choice, and really stifles innovation. And this allows incumbent firms to use their Certificate of Need laws to throw or delay entry to expansion in their competitors. So in the time sake of trying to make sure that we're concise and try to get through, we have some folks on the phone for limited invited testimony. I just don't want to ask committee members if they have questions. If they could let our office know, we can try to get those back to you in a most timely manner so we can allow these folks to try to get through their invited testimony as quickly and as expeditiously as possible. With that, Madam Chair, I believe we can start with our invited testimony.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. And first of all, I just wanted to mention to committee members, if there's an interest in going through a sectional, perhaps, we do have a new committee makeup this year. What's the will of the committee? Senator Stevens?
Madam Chair, I don't think we need that. I think all of us are familiar with it.
Okay. Senator Machicki?
I'm okay with not having a sectional today, Madam Chair.
Same.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Senator Wilson. I appreciate you being here. And if members do have questions, please feel free to send them to my office, and we'll pass them on to the sponsor. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
So now we will open public testimony on Senate Bill 62, and we will start with invited testimony. I know there are individuals waiting online, and anyone who is interested in testifying on this bill is certainly welcome. You can also provide written comments to my office through my staff, Natasha McClanahan. So the first person online to testify is Naomi Lopez Bauman, who's the Director of Healthcare Policy for the Goldwater Institute. Naomi, can you hear me?
Hi, this is Naomi Lopez Bauman from the Goldwater Institute. Can you hear me?
Yes, please feel free to provide your testimony on Senate Bill 62.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Naomi Lopez Bauman, and I'm Director of Healthcare Policy at the Goldwater Institute, which is based in Phoenix. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify in favor of SB 62 today as you consider this important issue of healthcare access. So why is SB 62 important for Alaskans? The reason is pretty simple. Today's certificate of need laws are putting profits above patients' healthcare needs and preferences, and it really is time to put patients first. Adopted in the 1970s, these laws require competitors' stamp of approval before providers can offer more healthcare services, such as opening a hospital. And con laws persist today only to protect existing hospitals from new competitors. So imagine what our smartphones, which we have now become almost, which have become almost indispensable in our daily lives, might look like if the manufacturer had to first get permission from its competitors. Would Garmin be, would Garmin allow smartphones to install GPS and Google Maps? Would Nikon allow smartphone cameras? And would the Yellow Pages allow us to Google business phone numbers? There should be little doubt that our lives have been clearly enhanced by these innovations. Now imagine that Alaska put patients first, allowing their communities and providers to decide what healthcare services would be offered there. In the same way, there shouldn't be laws against smartphone innovations. The state of Alaska also should not make it illegal or onerous to offer more healthcare service options and services, particularly those in rural areas. There really is a better way. Extensive research and analysis by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University has found that con laws reduce healthcare quality, they reduce access to care, they reduce availability of medical equipment that is so important in patient diagnosis and treatment. These effects may be more profound for patients in Alaska, since the ability to travel to other states for treatment can be prohibitively expensive and logistically very difficult. It's also important to point out that contrary to claims by some con proponents, con laws were originally established to counter the cost-plus reimbursement system. At that time, there was an incentive for facilities to expand their offerings regardless of demand, but today the cost-plus system no longer exists. Instead, hospitals are typically reimbursed a fixed amount by insurers for patient care, and that makes those con laws obsolete. And the same federal government that once encouraged the con system has even abandoned it. According to a joint statement of the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission, and I quote, certificate of need laws impede the efficient performance of healthcare markets. By their very nature, con laws create barriers to entry and expansion to the detriment of healthcare competition and consumers. They undercut consumer choice, stifle innovation, and weaken markets' ability to contain healthcare costs. Together, we support the repeal of such laws as well as steps that reduce their scope, end of quote. Alaska needs to begin putting patients first so that every Alaskan, especially the most vulnerable, can have access to the care that best meets their needs and access to the best technology and innovation at the lowest cost. Alaskans need to be free from con restrictions. I would be happy to address any questions that you may have. I've submitted written testimony, and thank you again for your time and consideration of this very important bill.
Thank you, Naomi. And if you could briefly tell the committee members about what the Goldwater Institute is.
The Goldwater Institute is a nonpartisan 501c3 research institution. We do a lot of research on public policy issues, a whole lot in the healthcare area, and we also are involved in litigation. We come from an individual liberty perspective.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other questions from committee members? Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, certificate of need, the subject of it for someone like myself that believes in a free market seems like a really easy decision. But I'm curious, Ms. Lopez Bauman?
Yes.
If you have, if you are aware of the history of hospitals in Alaska for huge swaths of the state that had essentially no medical services and counted on a certificate of need for development of those initial services. Have you worked much in Alaska?
Madam Chair and Senator Michiki, thank you for your question. If I may answer, so I have looked a little bit into some issues, and particularly I've examined the area of Juneau and now the now available treatments for cancer, which were not available previously, I believe about 15 or 18 years ago. And so I've done a little bit of research on that, and, you know, and certainly it seems from my research that consumers in that part of the state, it really has impacted their lives and made their lives better. You know, imagine a cancer patient at the worst time of their lives not having the option of treatment closer to home. Now, I realize that because of the geography of the state, that's not always going to be possible, but why would that be limited? And so that's, I think, that's something that's really important to think about, is how does that impact the patient, particularly when they're facing a very severe and serious medical crisis.
Madam Chair,
Senator Michiki?
I think we may be talking about two different things, but thank you for that answer. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Naomi, and for all the people either providing public testimony or invited, please feel free to provide your testimony in writing to the members. It's always helpful to have that as backup. Next, Dr. Hal Schertz, the founder of Docs for Patient Care Foundation. Dr. Schertz, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please feel free to give your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and committee members. Thank you for allowing me to participate and provide testimony in favor of SB 62, the repeal of CON in Alaska. My name is Dr. Hal Schertz, and I'm a full-time practicing pediatric urologist in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm the founder and the secretary of the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is the only healthcare think tank operated entirely by practicing physicians. Our foundation has been involved extensively in efforts around the country working to repeal certificate of need laws. We held a national conference in Washington, D.C. in June of 2017, which brought together experts on this subject from academia, medicine, public policy, patient advocacy, the legal profession, and state government. The consensus was that certificate of need laws harm patients both medically and financially. They stifle competition and innovation. They harm patients. They harm physician practices. And they further strengthen and enrich a hospital system, which has become the power brokers of medicine today. In addition to these issues, it may also be unconstitutional and violates anti-monopoly statutes. I'd like to direct the committee to my article, which has been submitted for inclusion into the record, which is entitled Eliminating CON Law is a Meaningful Step in Lowering Alaska's Healthcare Costs, which I co-authored with Alfredo Ortiz, who's the president and CEO of the Job Creators Network. I'd like to spend the next few minutes giving the committee my opinion as a policy expert and as a practicing physician. CON laws are a remnant of healthcare policy from the 1960s and 1970s that clearly no longer apply in this new era of healthcare. They came into existence to protect hospitals and nursing homes from competition at a time when medical services were predominantly paid for by fee-for-service. The federal government incentivized states to adopt these laws with funding that they terminated a decade later because the promises of savings and improved patient access, which were promised, were never realized. Nonetheless, states retained these laws because of the powerful lobbying efforts of hospitals, which benefited by eliminating competition. Fast forward to 2018. Most of the laws and regulations that are on the books in healthcare protect hospitals, and they give them carte blanche when it comes to controlling the healthcare market. Most hospitals call themselves not-for-profit entities, which simply means that they do not distribute the earnings to shareholders. These enterprises are, in fact, some of the most profitable entities in the community. Since 1970, the number of physicians across the country has gone up 100%, while the number of hospital administrators during this same period of time has risen 3,400%. The salaries for CEOs of the largest hospitals is typically in excess of $1 million annually, and those of other medical executives are not far behind. If you travel to any large city, the most ambitious building projects are those of hospitals, and the trend toward consolidation and mergers and acquisitions have positioned the hospitals as the power brokers of healthcare. This trend, which also includes the hospital acquisition of physician practices, has left patients with very little choice regarding where to get their healthcare. Simultaneously, hospitals charge fees that are 5 to 10 times that of the services received at outside facilities. There is no transparency or consistency regarding hospital fees. Patients have no idea what they're being charged, and two patients can have identical services and pay vastly different amounts for them. As an anecdote to illustrate the insanity of this situation, understand that hospitals are purchasing physician practices because it's good business for them. This is because they get paid often 10 times as much for the identical service delivered at the hospital as it would be at a doctor's practice. So, for example, if Dr. Smith, who is a GI specialist and does colonoscopies in his office-based GI lab, charges $200 for the colonoscopy, and a patient has a 20% copay, then they're responsible for $40. However, if Dr. Smith sells his practice to Anchorage General Hospital, he keeps the same office but simply changes the signage and then does a colonoscopy the very next day, that charge for the colonoscopy is no longer $200, but $2,000, and the patient is now responsible for $400 out of pocket. CON laws allow this practice to continue because competition is prevented. The losers are the patients. They no longer have any choice. Please give Alaskans a choice. Thank you very much. And anybody who has any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Dr. Schertz. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Gardner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Schertz, you referred to a publication or an article you had publicized, and I'm not seeing it in my list of supporting documents, and do you know if it's been submitted to us?
I given that article to Mr. Zepp, it was the article has been printed in the Washington Times in a different format, and we revised it specifically for Atlanta. So that article will be available to you.
Thank you.
Senator Gardner, the sponsor staff said they will provide that article to us. So thank you for asking for that. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Next, we have Dan Gilman, an attorney with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission. Mr. Gilman, if you can hear me, please feel free to provide your testimony.
Hi, am I audible over there?
Yes.
Great, thank you. Chairman Costello, Senator Wilson, and members of the committee, my name is Daniel Gilman. I'm an attorney advisor in the Federal Trade Commission's Office of Policy Planning. And with me today is David Schmidt, Assistant Director of the FTC's Bureau of Economics. Thank you for this opportunity to present the views of the FTC on Certificate of Need laws, often called CON or CON laws for short. Our prepared remarks review recent statements on the effects of CON laws issued jointly by the two federal competition authorities, the FTC and the Antitrust Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. In particular, we call your attention to the agency's joint April 2017 statement on Alaska Senate Bill 62 and CON laws, and request that you include that statement in the record of today's proceedings. These prior statements reflect the agency's extensive experience with healthcare competition, including several decades of law enforcement, research, and policy experience with the effects of provider concentration generally and CON laws in particular. Any additional comments we might make, including responses to clarifying questions, are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the FTC, any individual commissioner, or the Department of Justice. Con laws, when first enacted, had the laudable goals of reducing healthcare costs and improving access to care. However, after considerable experience, it has become apparent that con laws do not provide the benefits they originally promised. Worse, in operation, con laws can undermine some of the very policy goals that they are supposed to advance. As detailed in our written statement, we have identified at least three types of serious problems with con laws. First, con laws create costly regulatory barriers to entry and expansion. Those barriers can increase prices, limit consumer choice, and stifle innovation. Second, incumbent firms can use con laws to thwart otherwise beneficial market entry or expansion by new or existing competitors. Third, as illustrated by the FTC's experience in the Phoebe Putney case, con laws can deny consumers the benefit of an effective remedy following the consummation of an anti-competitive merger or acquisition. For these reasons, last April, we respectfully suggested that Alaska repeal its con laws, and we are here today to reiterate that suggestion. We urge you to consider all the ways that con laws may harm healthcare consumers, namely individual patients, as well as both public and private third-party payers. And those ways include these. One, entry restrictions tend to raise costs and prices. They also limit opportunities for providers to compete, not just on price, but also on non-price aspects of healthcare, like quality and convenience, that may be particularly important to patients. Two, impeding new entry into healthcare markets can be especially harmful in rural or other underserved areas. Con laws may delay or block the development of facilities and services where they are needed most, and they can reinforce market power that incumbent providers may enjoy in already concentrated areas. By concentrated, we mean concentration of the number of providers, not that there are many providers. Three, empirical evidence on competition in healthcare markets generally has demonstrated that more competition leads to lower prices. In particular, studies of provider consolidation by FTC staff and independent scholars consistently indicate that, and a quote from our statement, increases in hospital market concentration lead to increases in the price of hospital care, end quote. In particular, the best empirical evidence also suggests that greater competition incentivizes providers to become more efficient, and that repealing or narrowing con laws can reduce the per-patient cost of health care. Empirical evidence has not shown that con laws control spending, improve quality of care, cross-subsidize charity care, or improve access to care. We have found no empirical evidence that con laws have successfully restricted so-called overinvestment. We urge you to consider the detailed discussion of the available empirical evidence that is contained in the 2017 statement. We'd be happy to entertain questions about that as follow-up. We urge you also to consider that more targeted policies may be more effective at ensuring access to care without inflicting the same harm on competition and, ultimately, healthcare consumers. Thank you again for this opportunity and your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Gilman. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Gardner?
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony, Mr. Gilman. One of the arguments that I've heard in favor of Certificate of Need is that it helps hospitals who have to provide care to everybody regardless of their assets, their insurance, or whatever, and that having a lot of competing facilities drawing off some aspects of what they provide that subsidizes the things that nobody else wants to provide is a value to a community. Do you have an opinion about that? Does that make sense?
Well, I understand that that argument has been raised. There is some discussion of that in the written comments that we filed and in more detail in that 2017 joint statement. So we do understand that the con laws, by restricting the entry of competitors, can help those hospitals The important question is whether they help them in ways that confer those benefits, those anticipated benefits. So is it true that states in con laws have improved charity care or improved access to charity care? Another question you could ask empirically is it true that hospitals that have market power, it's very common for providers in rural areas, small towns that might have just a small hospital, do they in fact have more charity care? Do they in fact have more indigent services? Do they in fact provide more services to these communities? Now, it's a difficult issue to study, but the written comments do discuss several empirical studies, careful empirical studies of these, and it simply has not been found that the con laws foster this kind of charity care, and it has not been found that they do deliver sort of on this cost-shifting promise. And we might, point out a couple other things. One is that the cost-shifting promise is at least at some odds with the cost control promise. That is, there's a story here that they will exploit their market power to generate extra profits and spend it in a socially useful way. Well, they may intend to, but the evidence is lacking that they actually deliver on that promise, right? So I think that that is a key thing. And then, are there other ways to address this? So, for instance, in addition to Alaska programs, I would suggest you consult Alaska health officials and also the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, really, for the details about this. But, for instance, there is a significant federal program, the Medicare Critical Access Hospital Program, that does provide extra reimbursement for rural critical access hospitals. And so this is sort of one of the last vestiges of, at least within the Medicare program, a significant program of sort of cost plus reimbursement for a significant number of in-hospital services. So there's the possibility of more efficient and more direct ways to meet this policy goal. And then there's just really the question why the evidence doesn't show that con laws have helped rural hospitals meet this charity care goal. Is that helpful?
Thank you, yes.
Senator Machicki, did you have a question?
I don't.
Mr. Gilman, I have a question. This is Senator Costello. It's a little different than the charity care question. I want to know what happens to the emergency room?
What happens to the emergency room?
Yes, if this bill were to pass, what would happen to the emergency room?
Well, the hospitals that have emergency rooms, we have not seen any evidence of a decline in emergency services or basic hospital services or quality of care associated with the repeal of certificate of need laws. So there are other states that have done this. Some after the federal impetus was lifted some years ago, and some more recently, like New Hampshire. This has been studied, and I can't promise you what exactly will happen to every single emergency room, but we just haven't found any evidence that these laws have helped sustain emergency services.
We do have one question.
Senator Machicki?
I'm just actually curious, Mr. Gilman. I've been in the legislature for 6 years now, and this is the first testimony I can remember from an actual federal agency on a local issue. I'm just curious, are you speaking for the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, and is that an opposition to con laws and official stance of the FTC?
Well, I think there are two parts. There's a two-part answer to that. So my written statement, which I read for the first 5 minutes over the telephone here today, was screened and approved by the Federal Trade Commission. So I was authorized to read that by a vote of the commission. That is a commission statement. When I field these questions on an ad hoc basis, I don't have the commissioners in here with me. I'm doing my best, but those do not necessarily represent the views of the commission as the commission would state them. Now, I will say as well that that 2017 statement that I issued, the more detailed April 2017 statement, was jointly issued by the Federal Trade Commission and the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division. That was an official statement of the two agencies, the commission and the DOJ, not just staff opining on staff research. Those are official agency positions.
Follow up.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you. Not sure I heard.
And typically, we offer those when we have expertise and when local, when state officials request that input. So in with the 2017 statement, Senator Wilson had asked us for our input on SB 62, and that's what led us to consider particular wrinkles in Alaska and how we would apply our general learning to the questions he had asked.
So my follow-up question, Mr. Gilman, we live in a state that's sparsely populated, huge geographic area, hubs that provide treatment, and some other regional facilities. If you were to eliminate CON, we have an enormous cost of charity care in this state. Are the private entities equally responsible for charity care, or are they going to funnel them to the other institutions? What has been your experience in other states that is more than twice the size of Texas with the population of 734,000 that's extremely spread out with very limited availability of medical care?
No, I understand, sir. And in some respects, Alaska is unique, but we do have other states with substantial rural regions. And we do have other large states that where many people have concerns about care being delivered in rural areas. Many people have concerns about critical access hospitals and so forth. And so we have not done a special study about this issue in Alaska. And maybe in some ways that's missing, but in some ways that's an advantage. So what we have seen nationally is that con laws, including in rural states, do not improve charity care, do not improve the quantity or the quality of such care or the availability of care or access to care. And so we do understand that there is a concern what will happen in critical access hospitals. We simply have not found evidence that these rural hospitals, that remote hospitals, do a better job and thrive better under con laws than they do without them. We just haven't found that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gilman. Appreciate your testimony. And if you wanted to provide those written comments from the beginning of your testimony, we'd be happy to take those. Next, Matt Mitchell, the senior fellow, a research fellow from Mercatus Center from George Mason University. Mr. Mitchell, if you could hear us, please feel free to begin your testimony.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Can you hear me just fine?
Yes.
Excellent. Madam Chair Costello and distinguished members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Matthew Mitchell. I'm an economist at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, where I'm also an adjunct professor of economics. In recent years, my colleagues and I have been studying certificate of need laws in healthcare, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to discuss our findings with you today. Con laws require healthcare providers wishing to open or expand a healthcare facility to first prove to a regulatory body that their community needs the service they plan to offer. Policymakers hoped that these programs would restrain healthcare costs, increase quality, and improve access to care for poor and underserved communities. However, by limiting supply and undermining competition, con laws may undercut each of these laudable aims. Because 15 states have repealed their certificate of need programs, we have quite a bit of information to help us predict what would happen if other states, such as Alaska, were to repeal their con laws. Economists have been able to use modern statistical methods to compare outcomes in con and non-con states to estimate the effects of the regulation. These methods control for factors such as socioeconomic conditions that might confound the estimates. Table 1 in my written testimony summarizes some of this research. It's organized around the stated goals of con laws. Briefly, it is hoped that con laws will ensure an adequate supply of healthcare resources. The evidence suggests they do not. States with con laws have fewer hospitals. They have fewer ambulatory surgery centers. They have fewer dialysis clinics, and they have fewer hospice care facilities. Patients in these states have to have access to fewer beds and fewer medical imaging devices. They are more likely to leave their counties in search of care, and they are more likely to leave their states in search of care. The data suggests that an Alaska without CON would have 42% more hospitals than it currently does. Of particular interest to Alaskans, it is hoped that CON laws will ensure access to health care for rural communities. They do not. States with CON laws have fewer rural hospitals, they have fewer rural hospital substitutes, and they have fewer rural hospice care facilities. Residents of CON states must drive further to obtain care. And the data suggests that an Alaska without CON would have 45% more rural hospitals than it currently does. It's hoped that CON laws will promote high quality. They do not. Research suggests that deaths from treatable complications following surgery and mortality rates from heart failure, pneumonia, and heart attacks are all statistically significantly higher in CON states relative to non-CON states. In states like Alaska with especially comprehensive CON programs, that is, they require CONs for many different procedures, patient satisfaction is lower. Patients are much less likely to rate their experience as a 9 or a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. It's hoped that CON laws will encourage charity care. They do not. It is hoped that CON laws promote the use of hospital substitutes. They do not. And finally, it's hoped that CON laws will restrain the cost of care. They do not. All of this research is cited in my written testimony. I've also attached two working papers addressing the effect of CON on rural care and on spending, as I believe these papers should be of particular interest to your state. Given the substantial evidence that CON laws do not achieve their stated goals, one may wonder why these laws continue to exist in so much of the country. The explanation seems to lie in the special interest theory of regulation. Namely, CON laws perform a valuable function for incumbent providers of healthcare services by limiting their exposure to new competition. Research finds that existing hospitals, for example, are not affected by CON laws, whereas new hospitals and hospital substitutes like ambulatory surgery centers are. This helps explain why antitrust authorities at the Federal Department of Justice and at the Federal Trade Commission have long argued, as we heard today, that these regulations are anti-competitive and harmful to consumers. Thank you again for the opportunity to share my research with you. I look forward to answering any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Are there any questions of committee members? Seeing none, I appreciate you being available this afternoon. I think we'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
We'll take a brief at ease as Becky Holtberg from the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association comes forward with her presentation. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Welcome, Becky Holtberg. You're with the ASHNA, and we've heard from you before, but wanted to give you a chance to provide your testimony on Senate Bill 62.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Becky Holtberg, and I'm the CEO of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I have more slides than time, but no, never fear. I will move quickly, and I will extend the offer to any of you to come follow up if there are things that I have to go quickly over. Before I get into my presentation, I just want to say it was great to hear those perspectives from folks who are in the lower 48. I think their perspectives are perhaps valuable and relevant to a lot of markets, but I want to turn the attention back specifically to Alaska and give you just a few little fact checks before starting the slides. In Alaska, CON does not require a competitor stamp of approval. It is a rigorous state process. The cost plus system does exist in Alaska. All of our hospitals are paid based on cost by Medicaid, and our rural ones are cost plus under the Medicare methodology. Alaska, unlike many markets, is still primarily fee-for-service. And most states that have repealed CON laws have replaced them with something else through the licensing framework or some other framework. So I think those are just important things to remember as we move forward. So I just, out of this list of key questions, I want to really distill two things. The first is, will CON repeal actually do what we assume it will do, which is increase competition and through increased competition reduce costs? And what will the consequences be to our healthcare system if we take that action? So I'm not going to, you all are very aware, well aware of CON, but I want to highlight the third bullet, and that is that the state of Alaska has a vested interest in CON repeal because of state dollars spent on Medicaid. As an example, we have the fewest number of skilled nursing beds per capita in Alaska. Skilled nursing in Alaska is paid 85 to 90% by the Medicaid program. That includes cost-based reimbursement and a capital rate to assist in development, in construction, in covering the capital costs. So repealing CON could lead to the development of more skilled nursing beds, which would be paid for half through federal dollars and half through state general fund dollars. So the state of Alaska does have a vested interest in this program in protecting its own budget. So you've heard the primary criticisms of CON. Those are the assumption is that increased competition will lead to lower healthcare prices. The reality is Alaska's CON framework is actually pretty lax through regulation and the statutory framework. We have many ambulatory surgery centers and imaging centers in our largest market, and it is really not demonstrated through that extra through that competition any reduction in prices. So it's a question, will the theory even work as intended? But as I noted before, CON has limited skilled nursing facility development in the state. Not going to go through this model. This is the normal market. What happens in a normal market whenever competition increases? And again, happy to talk to you about this one at a later time when I have more time. But the assumption is that healthcare behaves like a normal market. And the reality is healthcare is not a normal market. There are a variety of reasons for this. Third parties pay the bill, so we're less sensitive to prices. There's asymmetric, not equal information between the people providing the service and those consuming the service. We care a lot more about quality in healthcare than we do, in some cases, about prices. So healthcare, we cannot assume that healthcare, as many of our speakers have, is a normal market and that it would behave the same. The reality is that competition in healthcare can actually increase prices. And I'm happy to show you studies that demonstrate this. Not going to walk through the model necessarily, but simply to note that in certain cases, competition actually results in increased prices. Why is this? Well, a simple analogy. A Starbucks on every corner means we drink a lot more coffee. And in healthcare, a proliferation of healthcare facilities means we consume a lot more services. Healthcare utilization goes up, and if competitors have nicer amenities and begin to compete on amenities, price can go up as well. So does CON address our cost problem? Lack of competition in the healthcare market is not commonly identified as a driver of healthcare costs. This is a list of the primary factors that you will see in many studies that are driving healthcare costs, but they are not necessarily directly related to certificate of need. So what are the values? Turning to that second part of the question, what happens if we do repeal? This is just a list of some of the values of CON. Again, not going to read the list. It's in front of you. But I want to turn to the hospital perspective and why hospitals specifically care about certificate of need. You can see the uncompensated care figures at Alaska hospitals. Unfortunately, I don't have 2016 data yet. I should have it here in a few more weeks. But very briefly, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act requires hospitals to see all, regardless of ability to pay, in their facilities 24 hours a day. That requires 24-hour staffing, and it requires diagnostic equipment to diagnose and treat those patients. Hospitals lose money very often on many of these services and make it up on others. So when services migrate outside the hospital, there is less volume to spread costs over. Hospitals see all payers, all people, whether they can pay or not, Some of the facilities developed outside of hospitals do not see those who cannot pay. They sometimes do not see Medicare or Medicaid either. But the hospital, again, still sees those patients. So you can't, so just a, another quick analogy. Say you had two fast food restaurants. One is required by law to be open 24 hours a day, and it is required to give its food away for free to anyone who cannot pay for it. The other one is not. And think about the implications of that on that market going forward. You can't assume that a normal economic market is functioning when one seller of a service has a legal and ethical obligation to provide services to some people for free and the others don't. So what is the value of a hospital in the community? A couple of points. Again, we talked about hospitals seeing all, regardless of ability to pay. I would note specifically the two Medicare clinics, primary care clinics in Anchorage right now, are run by the two hospitals. And then there are other services you can see up there that are that would be potentially could be state-supported services. They're valuable community services, but they are supported directly by hospitals. A hospital is like a public utility in some ways. You assume the lights will go on when you flip the switch, just like you assume the hospital will be there when you need it, when you have an emergency at 2 a.m. But there's a significant cost to maintaining that infrastructure and functionality that has to be paid for. And if we undercut the ability of the hospital to pay for that infrastructure, in some communities, we could be without that service. Another note, during the tsunami warning, where did people go in some of the communities where there was a tsunami warning? They went to the hospital because the hospital was open and the hospital is a safe place. And whether or not we have hospitals in all of our markets is an open question. This is from 2016. It notes hospital closures. There have been many more rural hospital closures since I last updated this chart, but I want to suggest that we cannot assume that we will maintain these services indefinitely given the current market. What are the facilities most at risk? Homer, Kodiak, Ketchikan, Soldotna, Fairbanks. It is many of our mid-sized facilities where there is a significant enough market that you could seriously undercut the ability of the hospital to operate successfully. So what is at risk? It is really the community hospital and this public infrastructure that is privately owned that provides these services, and sometimes publicly owned. This is a quote, you can't see it on the overhead, but on the slide. It's from January 29th of this year by a healthcare futurist who said, "Are community hospitals obsolete? It's a serious question. Just about every trend of late seems to suggest the days are numbered for many, if not most." There are bullets on that slide that talk about the reasons for that, and I'm not going to, you know, whether we agree or disagree with them, they simply are factors that we are having to deal with. So given these trends, how do we maintain viable community hospitals? That is a really key question. And the first step is don't make it worse. Do no harm. Hospitals face many challenges, and we all need to recognize some of the financial headwinds that many of these hospitals are facing, especially in our mid-size and our smaller markets. So again, this slide was just that the state of government has a public interest in the certificate of need process through the dollars spent on Medicaid and the potential increase in those dollars. And I won't reiterate that again. But really, what is this conversation? Part of this is about what we value. It's the value of the services that hospitals provide. It's the value of having facilities in our community that are willing and able to serve the poor and vulnerable. It is the value of that 2 a.m. emergency room visit and having that facility there with all the expensive staff and all the expensive equipment when you need it. So finally, do we have information to make this decision? And I'll echo what some of the previous speakers said. The traditional arguments for CON are empirically weak. But given the potential for harm to specific critical elements of the healthcare system, the Lewin Group in 2007 advised the legislature in Illinois to move forward with an abundance of caution. I would advise this body to move forward with an abundance of caution and to understand the implications of repeal on these specific critical elements of the healthcare system. And again, we think there's some opportunity to continue this conversation about CON regulations and about the healthcare system and its infrastructure going forward, and we would welcome that conversation. And thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions of Becky Holtberg from ASHNA? Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Holtberg, we are $750 million over on a supplemental budget associated with Medicaid. We spend $2.7 billion a year. Our UGF, it's the second largest source of expenditure for the state. I feel like we have no grasp on cost control in those departments. So considering the discussion we're having today, are there conversations taking place with more of a blend that may protect some of those critical services and help us keep the cost down, but that allows expansion of private innovation that might help bring the cost down as opposed to the old model? Are we looking at a new model that's a hybrid, and are those discussions taking place?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, first, given the state's existing regulatory framework for CON, there is already a lot of competition. I think we assume that there are very few imaging centers or ambulatory surgery centers, when in fact our regulatory framework provides a lot of vehicles for that competition already to take place. And if it were effective, we'd see much lower prices, but we really aren't seeing much lower prices. So I think there already is competition that we perhaps don't understand. From a healthcare provider standpoint, our goal, and I think what we all have to be aiming for, is how do we lower the total cost of care? That is a struggle that every state is having right now. It's about what we pay for. It's about how we pay, our payment methodology. If you go back to the slide about what's driving healthcare costs, these are the kinds of things that we have to look at. Not necessarily CON. So we have to begin to have different conversations about how over a person's life we lower the total cost of care. I know that's not a very specific answer, but I would say nobody has figured this out in our country, and we all are continuing to struggle with it. There are specific conversations happening among healthcare stakeholders in Alaska about these very questions.
Any further questions? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. One of our earlier presenters said Alaska without CON would have 45% more hospitals. That makes absolutely no sense to me. Half of our population is in rural Alaska, half in urban. I can't imagine 45% more hospitals in rural Alaska.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I cannot imagine 45% more hospitals either. I think that was a mathematical equation that doesn't necessarily take into account the geographic realities of this state, and while I appreciate the research that was done, I do not think that it necessarily applies to our market, and I think 45% more hospitals would also mean a lot more spending on hospitals in Alaska.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no more questions, thank you, Becky. Appreciate you being here. Next, I'm going to go to Margaret Brody with the Department of Health and Social Services. Margaret, would you please provide your testimony?
Madam Chair, this is Margaret Brody with Healthcare Services. I'm only here available for questions.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to go to the Delta Junction LIO, Mary Kaspari. If you could provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the Senate Labor Commerce Committee. My name is Mary Kaspari, and I am the president of the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation. I'm a 20-year resident of Delta Junction and an RN for 35 years. Delta Junction is located in the interior of Alaska, 150 miles south of the Arctic Circle, 100 miles from Fairbanks, and 200 miles to the Canadian border. The community has farming and ranching, timber harvest, Fort Greely military base, and a lot of hunting, fishing, and motorized recreation. My project started in 2011 while on call with Dr. Norman Petty. We were very busy one Saturday, and in the midst of it all, he made the comment, "You folks need to have a critical access hospital in this community." And my response to him was, "What is a critical access hospital and how do we get one?" That was the beginning of the project and the birth of the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation. A group of us got together with the mission to bring quality health care to Delta Junction service area. We obtained nonprofit status with the IRS by becoming a 501c3 organization. We initiated a feasibility study to evaluate our health care needs and collected $44,650 of donations from the community to pay for the study. The feasibility study revealed that our community could sustain a 10-bed long-term care facility along with a 10-bed critical access hospital with swing bed capabilities. The study also brought to our attention the locations of the critical access hospitals in Alaska. It pointed out that there was minimal medical care between Fairbanks and the Canadian border. In the summer of 2012, Roy and Janelle Gilbertson donated a 13-acre parcel of land to the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation. This was to be the home of our medical campus. In January 2013, we teamed up with Crossroad Health Ministries and applied for a new access point grant through HRSA for our first ever community health center in the interior. Also, at the time, the building of the quality care assisted living facility was well underway. On November 1st, 2013, we were notified by HRSA that we were awarded the new access point grant. With a stipulation, we had 120 days to get the community health center opened. On March 1st, 2014, 120 days later, and work from some very dedicated workers of Chris Morley's general contractor team, the Interior Alaska Medical Clinic was open for business. On March 13th, 2017, our retail pharmacy was opened, the Interior Alaska Pharmacy. Now we are on the last phase of the project, the construction of a critical access hospital with 24/7 emergency room coverage. We need this facility here. I have been involved firsthand with many emergencies in this community. One of the many emergencies that are embedded in my mind is the week-long ice storm. We couldn't get out by road or by air, and I had three pregnant moms in preterm labor and nowhere to put them. It took the rescue squad 5 hours one way to get a fractured hip to Fairbanks emergency room, and when they finally returned, begged me not to send them back up on the highway again. Which turns to the question, why do we have to have a certificate of need when there is no competition in a 200-mile radius? Why do we have to put a significant amount of money and time towards the completion of a certificate of need to get permission from the state to build this facility? We all know that we need this facility in this location. We need to focus our funds and time on the project and moving it forward sooner than later. The certificate of need needs to be dissolved. And if you are not going to dissolve the certificate of need, at least make a rule exemption effective immediately. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Next, I'd like to come back into the room and invite Carl Garber from HNET to testify. Can't leave? Okay. I'll go back to Delta Junction. Next, Randy Beeler, followed by Bill Ward.
Yeah, I'm Randy Beeler. I'm just representing myself. I just came down here. I'm not associated with any university or hospital or anything like that, but I kind of want to talk a little bit about my personal experience. I've lived here a long time. Why the need for a certificate of need? In the past, Delta Junction had the availability of medical air transport. The requirement of transport is having a 24-hour emergency medical facility. Delta Junction's 24-hour care ended a number of years ago. Delta Junction Healthcare has working man's hours. This is great if you get sick or injured during the week between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. Any emergency on weekends, holidays, or after hours requires an ambulance ride to Fairbanks. These trips are often over poorly maintained roads, even more so since the Birch Lake Highway Maintenance Camp was closed. 45 years ago, I was in a serious automobile accident south of Glen Allen. They had a small hospital where I was taken and given much-needed medical care. That little hospital was an oasis in the desert for me. When the small Glen Allen Hospital was in the planning stages, had a certificate of need been a requirement and the hospital denied its operation, my medical outcome might have been much different. Why must we ask for basic medical health care availability. In 2007, on a weekday evening, my wife Vicki had a stroke in Delta Junction. A local medical clinic still had 24-hour emergency care, so she was seen in our clinic and air medevac to Fairbanks. If the same scenario happened today, she would be put on an ambulance by an EMT and driven to Fairbanks before she saw a doctor. This is after hours. In 2013, after hours on a Friday, my son Steve was attacked by a yak. He was gored and his back was broken in four places. Even though it was after hours, our local doctor came in and gave emergency care. Steve then had to endure a very painful multi-hour ride jostling around a rough riding ambulance. I was raised here. My kids were raised here. My grandchildren are being raised here. Their certificate of need requirement is a roadblock standing between us and basic health care. With a mentality where high-speed internet to every remote corner of Alaska has become a focus, a certificate of need, having the ability to deny 24-hour emergency care and a small hospital for rural communities is not comprehensible to me. I support Senate Bill 62.
Thank you very much. Next, Bill Ward.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Bill Ward. I live in Delta Junction. I'm representing myself and my wife as a retired citizen in the community. I'm a 44-year resident of Alaska and 20 years in the Delta Junction area. My testimony is follows. The requirement for a certificate of need in Alaska statute is a classic example of how municipal hospitals and large healthcare organizations use this outdated law as a tool to strengthen their power base and thwart the legitimate medical needs of small Alaskan communities. Obtaining a CON requires professional staff, time, money, and political clout. The community of Delta Junction has demonstrated the need for a critical access hospital, proved the viability of developing a hospital project, has wide community support, and have provided the basic foundations to proceed, but we're being stymied by the requirement for CON. On a personal level, my wife and I, and many others who want to remain in rural Alaska as we age, but the lack of primary and emergency health care jeopardizes that desire. There have been circumstances where local people have been confronted with an accident or critical illness and not survive the two-hour-plus ambulance trip to the closest hospital in Fairbanks. The way medicine is practiced today, if you have an undetermined illness or trauma, the clinics and EMTs are obligated to send you to a hospital for diagnostic testing. For us to be sent to Fairbanks, it is expensive, time-consuming, sometimes an overreaction, and places a burden on the hospital ER. Even routine childbirths necessitate an expensive and cumbersome trip to a Fairbanks hospital. With all due respect to the presenter from the Alaska Hospital Association, the circumstances in Delta will not provide a detriment to the Fairbanks Hospital. It'll actually save them money because right now we send a lot of work into their ER. It could be handled locally. It does not burden their ER outlet. And it certainly expends a great amount of cost and frustration and health danger to the people living in Delta Junction. And said that all Alaskans deserve access to timely, qualified health care. The community of Delta Junction is prepared to promote, develop, and obtain funding for a critical access hospital. But we can't do that if you retain the outmoded and restrictive requirement for a CON first. I would encourage you that you move SB 62 out of Labor and Commerce Committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next, I'm going to go to the Anchorage LIO, where we have one individual who's there. Michael Jesperson, if you could provide your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, including my senator, Senator Gardner. I want to testify in favor of SB 62, and I want to point out that I have no dog in the fight. I'm here as an individual because I believe the best way to reduce retail pricing in any industry is more competition. I said I don't have a dog in the fight because I live in Midtown Anchorage. There's three hospitals, Alaska Regional, Providence, and Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, within a good golf ball drive of my house. If I need care, I can get it. My friends in rural Alaska have a bit harder time. When I lived in Bethel and my daughter needed emergency surgery, the hospital there had an ER that was able to stabilize her and get her on a flight so she could come to Anchorage and have her life saved. We need to give that to more communities. Alaska doesn't have enough psychiatric beds, or so we're told by listening to the local news. Removing the certificate of need reduces a substantial monetary cost to opening a new medical facility. Perhaps we could solve this problem with psychiatric beds by cutting the cost of opening a facility. A few years ago, Alaska Regional tried to open some unattached ERs, one in South Anchorage, and I believe the other was in Eagle River. They didn't because they couldn't get a certificate of need. People in South Anchorage are a lot farther from the hospital than I am, and depending on the severity of a heart attack, could be dead before they get to the hospital. A little while ago, we heard a person testify against SB 62, and their primary reasons were economic. I agree. Economics is the reason for this bill. If the other existing providers are so worried about competition draining money from them, that's a good thing. That means we need to get rid of the certificate of need, drain money, and potentially reduce costs. I'm not saying it'll happen overnight. It takes years to get construction permits and funding to build a new medical facility. But if we remove one hurdle, everybody is one step closer, doesn't need quite as much money, and a few more people's lives can be saved or at least made much more comfortable. I urge you to pass SB 62, remove the certificate of need, bring competition back to the market. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michael. Next, I'm going to go to Dr. Timothy Silba with the Alaska Emergency Medicine Associates. Next, Joe Fong with the Providence Medical Center is calling in from Seward. Joe, can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. If you could provide your testimony, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Fong. I serve as the administrator for Providence Seward Medical and Care Center. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on this bill. I would like to provide just a little clarification while we are titled and part of the Providence system. I would remind members that we are city-owned, and so our success does directly impact the city. It does not go back to the larger Providence organization. I wanted to provide a few comments and say that I absolutely support a conversation on whether or not the current seal and law is appropriate. However, I do believe that a full repeal is not the answer. And ask that you not move forward with SB 62 in its current form. I wanted to remind folks that in rural Alaska communities where we have our hospitals, we have generally very small margins, and specifically here in Seward, you know, we do rely heavily on our outpatient services like imaging, therapies, lab, and in some communities where they have surgical services, they rely on those in order to be sustainable. In our, to be able to offer 24-hour ER coverage, we can have as few as 1 to 2 patients in our ER in a 24-hour period in the winter months. And even in the summer when we're busy, we can have as few as 6 patients. And when you think about the cost of keeping an ER open for a community, that, you know, there's no argument that our community needs access to services. But if you remove a barrier, or if you incentivize others to come in and impact that does, it may result in greater competition, greater access in the short term, but in the long term, there's a huge potential for a negative impact on our ability to provide those urgent care and emergent services. I wanted to highlight an example in Seward where, you know, we recognize that we need this collaboration. In 2014, when an independent community health center opened, there was a very conscious conversation between Providence, between the community health center, and between the city that we wanted this to be a collaborative effort, recognizing that the hospital does rely on our outpatient services to survive and help defray some of the costs for some of our lesser services. To that, the community health center did not open competing imaging laboratory and rehab services and instead refer their patients to us. And that's one way that we have as a community tried to address this. If you look at other competitors, they may not have that same collaborative intent when they look at opportunities in these communities. Again, I know that there are a lot of nuances to the current CON law that needs to be reviewed. I fully support conversation around the current law, but I would urge you not to move forward with a full repeal. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Joe. Next, we have Dr. Richard Manzager from Providence Alaska Medical Center.
Hello, this is Dr. Dick Montager. I'm the administrator of Providence Alaska Medical Center. Madam Chair, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to comment. I want to make just a few comments and reemphasize a couple that have already been made. One of them is that hospitals are very much a public utility in one sense, in that the community needs us to be open all the time. The services that become competitive are typically daytime services. They don't tend to be nighttime or weekend services. And the community, in my view, needs the hospital to always be present. The business of medicine, unfortunately, in the United States is really complicated, and we spend a lot of money, but the businesses to support all 24-hour-a-day services in many communities is marginal. The other thing I'd say is our current CON statute, and I would echo Joe's comments, it's not perfect, and the regulations are not perfect, but it does one thing that I think is really useful for our state, and that it provides a forum and a way to talk through and rationalize services. As many people know that have paid attention to this kind of nuance of the healthcare world, we at Alaska Regional engaged in a vigorous debate around emergency room beds a few years ago. What it did is it provided, the current statute and regs provided a way to provide a community discourse and discussion. Recently, Alaska Regional and MATSU both were awarded certificate need approvals to build more behavioral health services. We did not oppose that and, in fact, have supported the development of more behavioral health services. We have some. We don't have enough. The community needs more. And it's really been a useful dialogue to talk through as a community, as communities, what is needed. Another thing I'd remind the committee is that our current regulations allow, differently from some of the states and some of the first comments, up to $1.5 million if developed by an innovator or a doctor, don't need certificate of need approval. So there's a great deal of service in Anchorage, for sure, that has been developed over the years outside of the hospital. That's our challenge in the hospital now, is we really are a place for really sick people, and to make sure that this can continue into the future is our challenge. So in summary, I too would urge that you not eliminate SB or Certificate of Need statute and please don't advance it. I would encourage instead that there continue to be dialogue about how to improve the regulations. Thank you so much, and I'm available for questions if you want to ask me any.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions from committee members. Appreciate your testimony. Next, again, I'll ask for Dr. Timothy Silbaugh with the Alaska Emergency Medicine Associates.
Can you hear me, committee members?
Yes, we can hear you.
Excellent. Sorry for the delay there. Thank you, Madam Chair and Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, for the opportunity to testify today on the impact of SB 62. I am the business manager of Alaska Emergency Medicine Associates, and we provide the emergency care at Providence Alaska Medical Center, and we speak today in opposition of SB 62. The CON process has been an important and effective process, which is essential for the state of Alaska to maintain not only access to high-quality care, but also to minimize excessive medical expenditure. Specifically, in 2015 and 2017, the Providence Alaska Medical Center applied to the CON process for the development of a pediatric specialty emergency care center. The CON process allowed for a thorough and thoughtful discussion of this proposal and for a competing freestanding emergency department proposal. In January of this year, the Children's Emergency Care Center opened at Providence Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage, and Alaska's children now have access to pediatric specialty emergency care that was previously not available in the state. In this setting, the CON process worked well for Alaskans and allowed resources to be applied in a thoughtful and efficient path that has increased access and care to Alaskans. Now, if the CON process were lifted, the outcome would be a proliferation of expensive facilities that would drive up costs while providing no coordinated benefit to Alaska healthcare system. Specifically, as Senator Costello asked earlier, from the perspective of emergency medicine, this would come in the form of an entity called freestanding emergency centers. Now, these freestanding emergency centers are unique facilities that do not exist currently in Alaska. They are emergency care clinics without an attached hospital, and they are allowed by federal regulation to charge the exact same hospital facility fee as a traditional hospital-based emergency department. The intention of this law was to provide these facilities in remote places much further away from hospitals than is actually applied in the market. In states such as Texas, where there is no CON requirement, these FSECs are ubiquitous, common throughout profitable communities. Essentially, they provide service in areas where the service isn't needed at much higher costs. The FSECs result in market increase in system costs, and they drive up unnecessary and expensive emergency care utilization. In addition, the financial expenditure for construction of these facilities directly translates into allowable increase in Medicaid fees to offset the infrastructure investment. So in summary, AMA opposes efforts to repeal the CON process as introduced in SB 62. The CON process provides thoughtful use of state medical resources, has been effective in developing a strong healthcare system, and has prevented the introduction of expensive and predatory medical entities that would drive up costs. Thank you. I'll take any questions if you have them.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I'll go to Ann Zink with the Alaska Emergency Physicians in Palmer.
Yes, can you hear me, ma'am?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Zink. If you could provide your testimony.
Yes, so my name is Dr. Ann Zink. I'm a full-time practicing emergency physician at MacDu Hospital out here in Palmer, Alaska. And I'm speaking in opposition of Bill 62. I don't believe that the CON law right now is perfect, but I think that there are some things that we need to think about before we oppose this. Before I really become more involved in healthcare, I may have altogether opposed a certificate of need process, thinking, as many have described, the importance of having competition and having people and states have the opportunity to practice. I'm going to shorten some of my testimony because much of it has already been said, but as mentioned before, the current certificate of need process in this state allows up to a $1.5 million build, which we've been seeing in MACU as well as Anchorage, where people have been able to build and competition has existed. But in Alaska, I think that we need to be careful of applying the rule that has been talked about before, which is really what is much more frontier medicine that is practiced throughout most of our country or most of our state. As mentioned previously, what was happening in Delta Junction, having access to emergency care is critical. I'm most concerned that repealing SB 62 will threaten emergency departments in two ways, and I'm going to give an example specifically at MACU. So if we have a surgical center here at MatSU and people are able to do their surgeries there and they're not required to cover Entolacol here at the hospital, then patients with Medicaid, Medicare, or uninsured may not have access to those emergency services if needed. Also, if surgeons from the lower 48 come up and practice at a surgical center and then go back down, we don't keep those services here in the state for when we need them in an emergency. Threatening the emergency services, we've seen a decrease in emergency medical care throughout the country in both states that have had as well as lost certificate of need, and the safety net is under threat throughout the country. So as we look forward, I think we need to look at other places that have been able to figure out ways to bend the cost curve. Whenever we look at how we decide on what we want to do for healthcare, I think we always need to put the patient first. I've seen the certificate of need process work well in the state in two specific ways. Dr. Silber just talked about the freestanding emergency departments, which in Texas and other states have really significantly increased costs without helping patient care, and that process was able to work well in the state to be able to put the patient first. And then my most recent experience was with our own hospital's certificate of need process for applying for behavioral health beds. It was a long, arduous, and somewhat times painful process, but I thought it brought the community together, and in the end, the state was able to approve those beds. And I think, as Dr. Montager said, brought us all together to discuss really what makes sense for our community and what doesn't. Alaska has unique challenges, and I think we need to look at what makes sense in each community. And for that reason, I oppose the bill SB 62. I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Zink, are there any questions? Okay, seeing none, appreciate your testimony and your patience. Next, David Morgan in Anchorage, and then I'll go to David Wallace with the MatSU Regional Medical Center. David Morgan?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. If you could provide your testimony, please. Yeah.
Okay. My name's Dave Morgan. I testified last year. Brief background, I have 31 years in healthcare finance and management. I was CFO of a 50-bed rural hospital in Indiana, Vermilion County. Worked at Bartholomew County, a 500-bed county hospital for 3 years as their budget director, and they have a rate commission like a utility. Then I've been in Alaska 26 years, 5 years as patient accounts manager at Providence Hospital, 14 years as reimbursement director at South Central Foundation, and 4.5 years as operations and had to fill in as double duty as finance director for Eastern Aleutian Tribes with 5 clinics in the Aleutians, and I lived in Sandpoint while I was doing it. What I really want to talk about, which I've already submitted and updated from the last time we did it, is not necessarily rehash the same issues, but I'd like to address a couple of forward. I did submit the Alaska state profile of what would happen about a certificate of need prepared by George Mason University. And I don't see anything in the report, which I'm sure Gary or Senator Wilson can give out, about beds and hospitals, but I do see significant reductions from their research on spending, especially in physician fees and other types of fees, improved access, and I think we've heard about Delta Junction and other areas, quality and quality measures that are in the study, particular to Alaska, and they're all positive trends. I happen to know a little bit about the Illinois process of getting rid of the certificate of need. I was down consulting with Kentucky about the welfare to work for expansion of Medicaid expansion for 30 days this year. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, they have had a reduction in overall costs with improved competition. And what they found in Illinois, just like Texas, was that the rural hospital, with the threat of competition, started changing what they're doing to become swing beds, to add long-term beds, to change the services that they delivered. So a lot of the hospitals may have left the hospital ranks, but a lot of that square footage went into other medical services in association with other hospitals. So I'm currently working on a paper with John Hopkins, and I took Kaiser Foundation, working with them, marketplace average benchmark premiums, which basically takes every state, takes their benchmark premiums, not theoretical, but what was really paid in insurance and health care. And it's not, we economists, I have a degree in economics and accounting, found that if you take from 2014 to 2018, those states without certificate of need had a lower rate of increase than those states that did over a 3.5 year period, with one exception. California, which doesn't have certificate of need, but what we found was they have embedded regulations even more severe than certificate of need, plus major health care taxes, which have helped to raise those costs. So there's always outliers. There's always exceptions. Yes, it's a complicated business. I've been doing it 35 years. I barely understand it. But when you hear the examples given by proprietary, even if they're nonprofit, how the effect will be, they're x-raying and looking at one section, not at the total cost of health care in the state or in the community. And I heard this morning, I heard Senator Geisel talk about there's a 3-year wait for behavioral health. I personally was helping, consulting to a for-profit entity that wanted to build a 60-bed lockdown behavioral health and alcohol addictions. And the cost of the certificate need fight that we were going to have, remember, we pay taxes, we pay property taxes because it's going to be either here in Anchorage or in Eagle River, which is in the municipality. Because what I found in dealing with certificate of need, the economic issues, but who's, and I think when you look at a lot of the ambulatory facilities and especially a lot of the other activity areas outside of healthcare, look at who owns it or look who has a material interest. And I think it will lead you to look more closely at this issue of certificate of need. So just like the last time, and I thank my friends at George Mason, and I thank my friends at John Hopkins, and I very much thank my friends at Kaiser Family Foundation. With the statistics they sent me last night, I have sent most of the information on Alaska from George Mason on what would have happened without it, and I'll send this to Gary on the marketplace benchmarks for insurance costs or healthcare costs that make those up with a 4-year study, so we can see which states that don't have certificate of need and which states do, and rank them as to how much those costs have grown percentage-wise, not from one year to another year, but for 4 years. And I think it's very surprising. So I thank you for the time. Is there any questions?
Senator Gardner has a question for you, Dave.
Thank you. Thank you, David, for participating. Will you share that information with us when you have it ready?
Well, I've sent everything up to Gary, which is about 15 pages, except for this study I just got, utilizing Kaiser Foundation information. I'll have that done momentarily, and I'll make sure it gets to Gary and to Senator Wilson. I have to say, I kind of, even though I'm doing consulting work, I kind of felt an obligation because I served, I was honored to serve, 6 years on the State Health Care Commission and 8 years on the Municipal Health Care Commission, sharing it, and so I kind of felt like I need to give a little back. And by the way, Senator, you are my I am a constituent of yours. I'm calling from right over at Stanford Drive. So I'm glad to see you and hear you. I'm watching you on TV right now.
Thank you, David, and I'm very aware you're my constituent. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to actually go back to Margaret Brody, who's been listening. She's with the Department of Health and Social Services. Margaret, are you still online?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. So far, no one has mentioned what the cost of an application for a certificate of need is, and I know it's a pretty exhaustive application process. And then the time frame in order for the department to get a response back to the applicant. And if you don't have that information handy, if you could provide that to the committee, please.
Madam Chair, I believe Donna Stewart, who is the executive director of the Office of Rate Review, is better to answer those questions because it falls under her purview.
Okay. Do you happen to know, I'm looking, is she listening?
She is listening.
Okay, Donna, did you hear the question? Yeah, I don't see her as somebody signed on, but perhaps we'll follow up with her. I think that'd be interesting to know. So next, I'm going to go to Don Warren with the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation.
Good afternoon, Chairman Costello and members of the committee. My name is Don Warren Frazier, and I've lived in Delta Junction for 37 years. Our small community, as you know, is 100 miles south of Fairbanks on the road system, and we have no hospital or emergency services within 100 miles in any direction. Communities like Choke, Northway, Chicken, Eagle, Paxson all come through here to go to emergency medical services in Fairbanks. They don't have anything like this either. In an effort to improve our lives here, several members of the community formed the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation. We in the community are shopkeepers, farmers, retirees, a nurse, a contract worker, and an accountant. Just regular folks looking to improve our healthcare options for our friends and neighbors and our family. Through our grassroots efforts, we have helped to open the first retail pharmacy here ever in our area and a community health clinic. Our next phase is a critical access hospital, hopefully, much like Valdez, Nome, Wrangell, and Cordova have. We serve Alaskans all the way to the Canadian border, south to Paxson and north to Salsha and North Pole. This hospital could provide us with 10 hospital beds and a 24/7 emergency room. Just thinking about the lives that might be saved by this is thrilling to me. As you can imagine, raising funds in our rural area can be tough. We've gathered some funds to proceed with the hospital project, but have discovered that we must acquire a certificate of need before we can proceed. The requirements to apply for this certificate of need, we estimate, will cost us close to $200,000 to prepare and submit it, just to get permission to proceed with our project. My understanding is that the certificate of need program is used to control the amount of similar facilities in an area. We have no like facilities for 100 miles in any direction, yet we must now spend months and months and thousands of dollars putting together the requirements needed to submit our request for this certificate of need before we can even begin to work on our project. This seems so absurd to me. I believe that the certificate of need program should be ended by Alaska so that free market principles can continue. And if that's not possible, then I ask that you at least consider an immediate exemption for small rural areas like Delta Junction. Please help us to put that $200,000 towards our critical access hospital rather than using it for permission. Thank you for your time. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. Again, Margaret Brody, I have a question for you from Senator Gardner, if you're still listening. Sorry about that, Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Are you on?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. This is Senator Gardner, and I just wanted to know if the state and your department will be taking a position on this bill.
Senator Gardner, through the chair, I don't believe we are taking a position.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I'm going to John Lewis, followed by Joshua Russell, both in Delta Junction.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Madam Chair and members of the board, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you regarding the Senate Bill 62, Removal of Certification of Need. I'm John Lewis, Vice President of the Interior Alaska Hospital Foundation. I'm also a 14-year resident of Delta Junction and an 82-year-old senior. I'm in support of the Senate Bill 62, the removal of the certification of need. There is no need for a certification in a rural community. The closest hospital is Fairbanks, which is 100 miles away. The cost of the certificate of need is great expense, and the money used for that completion should be used to do the project. I believe our community should receive an immediate exemption from the requirement of the completion of need and for need, and our project building a small rural hospital with critical care certification. We need to increase the level of medical care and service in Delta Junction and areas with a small rural hospital with critical access certification and with radiological services. In the 14 years a resident in this community, I had several experiences of being flown out of Delta to Fairbanks and Anchorage for further evaluation, only to be released in the early morning hours and finding transportation back to Delta Junction. In closing, I ask you to please eliminate the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Next, we'll go to Joshua Russell.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the community. I was not grown in Alaska. I was flown to Alaska, as the phrase goes. Everybody here is familiar with the sheer size and scope of the great state of Alaska. We have half of this state's population, roughly, living in and around Anchorage and that borough, and the other half does not. Since I've been sitting here listening to the proceedings of this committee and the testimony from those that have testified, I've heard a handful of things, including that rural communities have counted on a certificate of need in order to provide services. I've heard the madam from Anchorage say that we have lots of options, perhaps in Anchorage, but not in the rest of the state. I heard the gentleman from Seward agree that people need access to emergency medical services, and that's what I'm specifically referring to, is emergency medical services. Yet no one seems to want to get rid of a roadblock to that access for emergency medical services for half of the state. I'm a father of four with another one on the way. I'm a 37-year-old disabled veteran with my own health problems, and I am a state of Alaska certified emergency medical technician. I only represent myself and my family in this case, but anyone involved, especially in pre-hospital medical care, has heard the term the golden hour. That means that from an hour, within an hour, within 60 minutes of your injury or your sudden need for medical care, if you can get into a surgical suite within an hour, your chances of survival are much higher. Here, in this community specifically, the hospital running with lights and sirens on and an ambulance in ideal road conditions, the hospital is 90 minutes away. We are already outside of that golden hour. In my time here, I've been in Delta Junction since 2015, and I've only been working as an EMT for under a year. But we've had heart attacks, emergency childbirths, traumas, and their chances of survival, despite the care that we can give them in an ambulance and with the local clinic here from the Interior Medical Clinic, their chances of survival and better quality of life are going to be increased by having access to the 10-bed critical access hospital that we're proposing here in Delta Junction. $200,000, which is the estimated cost of preparing the certificate of need, is a lot of money. I heard the madam from Anchorage say that if there was more Starbucks, people would drink more coffee. Well, that might be true, but if someone told Starbucks they had to prepare a $200,000 certificate in order to open another Starbucks, we would have fewer Starbuckses. Human beings are not businesses. And while we are in the business, if you will, of trying to care for our fellow citizens up here, we should not look at them the same way as we would look at other businesses. Okay, if this is a free market, then if more competition is not going to be successful, then it won't be successful. However, if it will be, then it will be. And here in Delta Junction, we do not have competition. In summary, everyone seems to agree that we need this access to medical care, especially emergency medical care, but no one seems to want to help us get that access. I ask you, as a father, as a member of this community, please do the right thing and forward Senate Bill 62. If nothing else, you must include an exemption for rural communities like this. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Joshua, for your testimony and also for your service to our country. Next, I'd like to invite David Wallace, followed by Mike Powers, to testify. David, with the Mat-Su Regional Medical Center.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. This is Dave Wallace from Mat-Su Regional Medical Center. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to the committee regarding Senate Bill 62, and I would like to speak against the wholesale repeal of the CON as it currently stands for a lot of the same reasons that my colleagues have put forth. In particular, Dr. Zink, who I get to the pleasure of working with each day, is much more eloquent than me in laying out the challenges we face each and every day in the Valley taking care of people. But as I sit here listening to the testimony, it'd be wrong for me to not point out the challenges of all of the great testimony from Delta Junction and feel for those people that are struggling to get basic health care. So clearly, there can be improvements to the Certificate of Need. And I think, as Becky rightfully pointed out, on behalf of the Hospital Association, we would want to be part of those discussions because there are undesired consequences of the CON statute as it currently sits, and there could be improvements that would take care of some of the inefficiencies that we all face with the bill, but allow for healthcare to continue to evolve in this great state. With the respect of the earlier testimony from people that are out of state, I would simply just suggest that what I've learned in the short time I've been here is that Alaska is different than any other state, and I think most people up here would agree with that. However, we can learn some things from what has worked well and what we need to work on. And therefore, I would say a full repeal of this is not warranted at this time without careful consideration of the negative consequences. I'll give you a quick example. This morning, I did not plan to spend an hour and a half in a meeting with the state. We had an unannounced disaster drill. Now, I, along with about a dozen of our leaders, sat in our command center and participated, and I think learned a lot and benefited from the state representatives that were here observing how we responded to a drill for mass casualty. That is how we partner with our state for providing services. We didn't receive any compensation for our work today, nor do we expect to. And I think we feel better prepared after the drill than before with how to deal with disastrous situations as they arise. Across town, I have competing imaging center that kind of went around the CON law, but established here, was not forced to go to undo what they've done. And although they lost their appeal, they are operating today in competition with our imaging department. I have competing surgery centers. I have other imaging centers that are going in competition with me using the expansion capabilities of the $1.5 million development expansion provision in the current bill. I'm not lamenting that. Being part of a hospital team that takes care of the needs of a community like the Mat-Su Borough is one of the greatest joys that I've had in healthcare over the last 25 years. But we need to work together, and we work together with the state, and I'm confident that we can work together to improve this bill, and would ask for your consideration of careful consideration of how we alter the bill rather than just a wholesale repeal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Mike Powers with the Tanana Valley Clinic and Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. Mike, the committee does end in about 15 minutes, and I believe you're the final testifier.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Mike Powers, CEO at Tanana Valley Clinic, a 65-member provider, multi-specialty clinic, formerly 30 years as 10 as Chief Financial Officer at Fairbanks Memorial, 20 as CEO. Over the past 30 years or so, we've had a number of certificate of need approvals, heart center, surgery, room, radiation therapy, long-term care beds, behavioral health beds. And most important, it's been alluded to by the prior speaker, responsive and effective ER services, a build-out. In my time here, we've had three mass casualties where two bus rollovers and an airline crash just flooded the room after hours, and the entire town shows up to take care of the injured. We've had a number of CONs not approved, imaging centers, some outpatient surgery suites. But each of these efforts went through the CON process, and the community was engaged. There was rational, thoughtful health planning deployed. There was high-quality, right-sized health capacity created. And I want to emphasize that important planning function of the CON. Over the years, I can appreciate our neighbors in Delta Junction and the desire for a critical access facility. In fact, I've written a letter of support for them in the past. Fairbanks would love to see additional capacity there. But it has to be done constructively, or you're not going to provide the service that can stand the 24/7 test of quality and consistency. Whether it's a larger community that runs a risk of duplicating only the profitable services without a certificate of need, or whether it's a smaller community, like Fairbanks, that essentially went 20 years before they could justify a cardiac cath lab, it is important to go through the appropriate planning to ensure judicious, efficacious, quality service. TVC, Tanana Valley Clinic at Fairbanks Memorial, supports the state considering regulatory changes to continue to improve its health planning responsibility, and thus speaking in opposition of SB 62. One final thought, as I listen to a number of the early speakers, Senator Wilson and the representative from the Goldwater Institute, Dr. Schertz, clearly, there are differences of opinion on the data. That importance of Alaskan data in charity care provided and who is providing these services is essential, and I encourage you to really seek out that Alaskan data. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your patience and your testimony this afternoon. Is there anyone in Juneau who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 62? Please feel free to come forward. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Carl Garber, and I signed up earlier, and I had to step out, so I'm back. I'm the executive director of Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska. I'm also a former nursing home administrator for over 10 years in the state of Alaska, and I'm currently the president of AgeNet, and so I'm here representing AgeNet today. AgeNet is a statewide association of agencies who provide home and community-based services for seniors. And these seniors typically have nursing home level of care needs. We serve over 10,000 seniors annually, and we help them to remain living safely at home for as long as possible. And we do this through providing in-home personal care, adult day services at senior centers during the day, Meals on Wheels, and many other programs that keep people living safely at home. In this process, we prevent adverse events from happening. So we prevent falls, missed medications, missed meals. That prevents high cost hospitalizations and long-term nursing home stays. We support the continuation of certificate of need for nursing homes. We don't need and can't afford more nursing homes in today's budget challenges. The best use of resources is to focus more on the development of home and community-based services. Today, Alaska ranks fifth in the nation for our long-term services and supports. This is a study recently released by AARP. This is in part due to our certificate of need law, which requires identification of the need and the best use of state resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl, and thank you for your advocacy and for being here. I'm glad you came back.
All right, thank you.
Are there any questions for Carl? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify? Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 62? Okay. Seeing none, public testimony is now closed on Senate Bill 62. And we are now at the end of our meeting. Senator Wilson, we did have another one of your bills on the schedule, but we'll have to get to that at a future meeting. So thank you for being here and listening to the testimony. If there's any materials that you wanted to share with my committee aide, we'll make sure that the committee gets those. And if there are any questions from committee members that you'd like the sponsor to answer, or perhaps the Department of Health and Social Services, please feel free to let us know. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. To that point, Madam Chair, I am surprised that the state's not taking a position here, but I'd like to hear from our state about, you know, what they see as changes that they might agree are in order or appropriate, and what they see as sort of the strengths and weaknesses, because my understanding is certificate of need is kind of means a lot of different things in different places, and I don't have a good sense of how we are like other states and what ways we're different and where our strengths and weaknesses are.
Thank you, Senator Gardner. It is a complex issue, and I will reach out to the department and ask for more engagement in the process.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, with that, committee's adjourned.